Here's Ken Carty.
Hi, and as Jack said, we're going to have time after the in the last sort of 40 minutes or so of this afternoon to come back and ask questions about anything that went on today, so you can feel free to do that. We've decided at the very useful suggestion of some members from last week that before every session we'd produce on your desks just a kind of a copy of the slides with a few lines for people who want to make notes as we go along. Because sometimes it's a little harder to follow in text material, but this is an easy way and as things occur to you. So we're going to do that, and before each session we'll just kind of plunk them down, and it provides a kind of easy guide to following along, and you can see how many more there are to go or whatever is turning you on. Okay, well, we're going to talk about political parties this afternoon and party competition, and try and come to understand that and the role of parties in the whole political process. And in fact, we don't get very far in discussing elections without beginning to come to grips with the whole idea of political parties and the question of them. And indeed, of course, one of the basic criteria of measuring electoral systems, does a party get the same share of seats as they does votes, implicitly means that elections are partly about parties, if that criteria is appropriate. If you didn't have a system based on political parties, of course, that criteria wouldn't come into play. It would be simply a system of independence. So parties are at the heart of a good deal of what we're talking about, and they're at the heart, of course, of how we understand elections to work. One of the striking things we know about electoral systems in working democracies is that there are virtually none that don't have political parties of one kind or another, whether they be parliamentary systems like in Canada, whether they be of the kind of parliamentary systems we have in some of the European countries, whether they be in congressional systems like in America, all of those democratic systems have evolved political parties of one kind or another to sort out a series of political problems. It appears that political parties go along with democratic elections in large-scale societies. There are a few places, and indeed the Northern Territories in Canada are a couple of them, where in fact political parties, at least on the surface, don't operate the system, but that seems to exist only in really very small-scale, much more personal-sized kinds of societies. So a number of questions raise themselves. But before we do that, we want to think political parties don't have the best kind of public relations. We know that if we ask Canadians what they think of political parties, we get the kind of responses that you can see on this on these screens here. I have a little pointer. I don't know how it'll work. 69% of those people who are polled when asked, Do politicians, when they're elected, soon lose touch with the people who elected them? And they say yes. 7 out of 10 Canadians think that. 3/4 of Canadians say, well, you know, we'd be way better off if we take those problems out of the hands of politicians, just return them to the kind of ordinary grassroots people, and they'd solve them in a better way. Over 80% of Canadians say that we'd have better laws if MPs would go to the parliament or the legislature and vote for their own conscience and what they think is important rather than voting the party line. Now, those are all implicitly anti-party sentiments. People saying parties are getting in the way of the expression of the preferences of the politicians and of the people who elect the politicians. But on the other hand, if we ask Canadians, well, could you have a political system without political parties? 69% say, well, no. You really can't have working democracy, a true democracy without political parties. So there's a kind of deep ambivalence in our kind of reaction to political parties. On the one hand, we think they get in the way, they change the transmission of preferences. But on the other hand, there's a kind of instinctive understanding that they are somehow at the core of how we do democratic politics. So trying to sort out some of this is really what we want to think about, because our attitudes towards political parties, the kinds of parties, the number of parties, are going to be fairly critical in our beginning to make some assessments of different kinds of electoral systems. So we've got lots of questions to ask, and maybe we can get through some of them today. I hope so. Why do political parties exist everywhere? The fact that they exist virtually everywhere suggests that they must solve some pretty common problem. They're not idiosyncratic to this country or that country. Can we have electoral politics with no parties? What would that look like? And how might we think about it? Does the electoral system have an impact on the shape and the number and kind of political parties? So if we have to have political parties, You know, can we kind of almost manipulate the numbers of them and the kinds of parties and the way they compete if we change the electoral system? What happens to parties when we do change the electoral system? What does the evidence suggest? And if we have time, if I don't go on too long, we can talk a little bit about the kind of parties that we have in Canada and how they work now. Well, I think that we really come to the question about why parties, and in some sense, parties exist to solve a number of real political problems that exist out there in the system. And there are two kinds of people who have problems. There are politicians who are trying to make a kind of complicated parliamentary system work, make a legislature work, make a government work, make the connections between them work, the kind of things that Campbell was talking about this morning. And there are, of course, voters. So what are the politicians' problems? Well, they have to find a device, an organizational way to build an electoral support base. They need an organization in a society of thousands and tens and hundreds and of thousands of voters to kind of build support bases for their kind of views and preferences. If you had a society in which there were only 14 voters, politicians could go and knock on all 14 doors, have a chat, sort it out. If you've got 40 or 50 or 60 or 70,000 voters in a district, you need a kind of way to assemble an electoral support base. If you get elected, politicians then are in a parliament and they've got to find a way to kind of coordinate legislative activity. The kind of thing Campbell was talking about this morning, to build a kind of coalition that will support a government and that will organize it. So coordinating legislative activity, I mean, you could have just 100 independents and they can kind of sort it out on a day-by-day basis, or you can try and find a way to kind of coordinate that in an ongoing, disciplined way. Politicians need organizations to help them kind of define the political agenda. What are the things on the agenda that need to be dealt with, that support has to be built for, that people need to learn about and work for? And, of course, politicians need an organization that will help them organize government and manage its activity. And in all these ways, political parties have evolved as the kind of organization of politicians to do that. And they solve all those kinds of problems. They're an organizational solution to a whole series of concrete day-to-day problems that politicians have. Well, of course, voters have different kinds of problems and different kinds of perspectives. Voters' problems are rather different. They want to make elections more than just a choice maybe of elected local representative. They might want to make it a kind of collective decision-making event. So that when Brad votes in Coquitlam and Mary votes in Prince George, are they participating in the same kind of process? Is it a kind of collective activity rather than just simply a series of individualized activities? The voters need some kind of organization that will help them recruit leadership and train it and bring it into the public sphere and identify possible leaders and allow them to help choose amongst those. And they need organizations that then help them hold those in power accountable. An organization that they can operate through to scrutinize the government and to replace it, if necessary, at election time. So there's a whole series from the voters' perspectives of political problems. And again, political parties are the organizations that really represent a kind of response to solving those problems. So parties emerged in countries when elections emerged. And you see the process of the spreading of the franchise, more and more people being given the vote, and politicians and voters suddenly had these kind of problems. Nobody had these problems when Henry VIII was ruling England. But as soon as there was a society of voting citizens, these political problems emerged, and slowly in different countries, parties were invented from the ground up. In different ways, they come to look much like one another, because they solve fundamentally the same kinds of problems. They vary a lot from country to country because there are different traditions and different institutions, but basically they're solving the same kind of problems. So we can see that there are organizations then to articulate and package ideas and interests in the society. There are organizations that recruit candidates for office. Then to campaign at election time saying, this is what we stand for, vote for us, or if you don't like us, as Mr. Trudeau used to say, you know, go vote for someone else. But that's really saying to them, look, choose. This is what we're for, that's what they're for, and organizations are about us giving you our identifiable position, campaigning for it, saying that it's right, and this is why we want to do it, but you get to choose in the end. Elections, parties help structure the electorate so that the electorate can recognize who's on what side and how it's organized, and whether it's structured in class terms or religious terms or linguistic terms or rural-urban terms, or all the different ways in which parties organize in different societies. They provide a kind of structure and logic to the way that politics is organized. And, of course, at the end of the day, parties are central to organizing and operating governments and oppositions, all the kind of things that Campbell talked about this morning. So we have a range, then, of fundamental activities that are going on. We can think, in some sense, of political parties, I like to think of them as kind of public utilities. You know, we all want electricity, or most of us want electricity, and we create a kind of elaborate organization and infrastructure to provide it. In this province, it's BC Hydro and other places. It might be a series of competing hydro companies. There's nothing special about BC Hydro. It's simply a device to generate and bring us electricity, the product that we want. Well, in some sense, we can think of political parties as organizations that deliver what we want in a democracy. That is, electoral competition and a device for accountability. They're, in some sense, utilities that provide for democratic choice, democratic organization, democratic accountability. So they're a kind of public utility that make democracy work. And we have the rules of parliaments and the rules of elections, and that's an institutional framework. It doesn't have meaning unless someone can make it work. And it's the parties that make it work and give us what we want. Democracy, that's about choice and accountability, I guess. Like most other public utilities, political parties tend to monopolize the field. There's usually a small number of them. And, of course, it's that kind of capacity for them to monopolize and dominate that makes us want to regulate them in various kinds of ways, because they have a very critical kind of position to play. Well, how do political parties manage to do all those things? Well, one of the keys to that is, in fact, what we talked about this morning, party discipline. It's party discipline that gives them a kind of coherence and ability to provide for these things. Because political parties work because the members essentially voluntarily agree to campaign on the same issues as a team. They agree to vote together as a team in the legislature. They agree to defend one another and to defend their leaders. And that's what we mean by party discipline, that they agree to play a kind of team game. So party politics is a kind of team activity, and you put on the shirt of your favorite team, and, you know, your team, right or wrong, because you're in a contest in some sense with other teams. And so party discipline is a really kind of a voluntary activity, and anybody any day can simply walk away from it. But the other members of the team are going to say, okay, you're not part of us anymore. So in some sense, that's all we're really doing. And so party discipline is a device that essentially crowds out independence. It says we're not going to operate Parliament as a kind of collection of independents. We're going to operate Parliament as a team kind of game, because there are enormous advantages for us to do that. We know, of course, that Canadians don't like party discipline. That's part of the story we talked about a minute or two ago. 83% say we'd be better off if MPs voted the way their constituents thought best rather than voting the party line. So there's a kind of deep-rooted, instinctive kind of hostility to the notion of party discipline. And there's a real tension here, eh? Because if we want to have a kind of parliamentary system with identifiable organizations that we can hold responsible, that will campaign together on common platforms, they need to be disciplined, because that's all we really mean by discipline. At the same time, that means they don't kind of necessarily vote the way their constituents want, because the team has to make some kind of collective agreement on what they're going to stand for. And, you know, if you're a Liberal in Cranbrook and the party as a whole decides they're going to do something that the people of Cranbrook aren't that keen on, you either go along with the rest of your team or you have to bolt it and go somewhere else. That's essentially the nature of the game. If, in fact, we didn't have so-called party discipline, I think you could argue that, as far as voters are concerned, elections would lose a kind of collective dimension. We wouldn't be engaged in a kind of collective decision-making process. In the last election, if there was no party discipline, There would have been no effective way to vote for or reject the previous government. It would have simply have been dealing with your local MLA and hope that somehow when they got to Victoria that it would kind of add up in a way that you would like. The governments couldn't have a mandate without party discipline. They couldn't say, well, we've campaigned on this platform and we're going to do it. One of the reasons we have a citizen assembly is because the party that happened to campaign the last election made it as one of their platforms. It said, you elect us and we'll establish a citizen's assembly. You know, if the public had elected a different party that didn't have it in their platform, the other party probably wouldn't have done it. So that's, you know, a kind of simple example of how mandates and platforms work. And of course, as I say, voters couldn't hold governments responsible without discipline. For politicians, of course, without party discipline, governments would have no stable kind of base. They couldn't count on controlling a majority and organizing. And the legislature would then depend on day-to-day bargaining. And you could run a legislature like that. In some ways, the American Congress runs like that. The reason, of course, it doesn't work in this system is because the incentives to discipline are powerful. I mean, you may, to go back to our friend from Cranbrook, say, well, look, the party and the government is going to do something that my people don't like very much. But, you know, gee, to be part of the government and to get all the other advantages and benefits, I'm going to go along with it. I'm going to pay this particular price. So party discipline, in some sense, is the price of power, because the most disciplined and the most successful party is a group that wins. And so you can see why politicians think, oh, let's form a political party, because if we can get a majority, we can control the government. You know, if we don't get a majority, somebody else will. But so politicians have enormous incentives. That's the politician's problem. How can we build an organization that will give us power? So in some sense, party discipline we might think of as the price of power in parliamentary systems. Works pretty well. So as I said before, parties work the way they do because voters have agreed to do these things. Maybe I've gone in the wrong direction. Okay. So that really kind of leads us to this kind of conclusion and a recognition that parliamentary politics, as it's emerged, is a kind of team game. Parties don't like independent members because, of course, they, in some sense, are running against that kind of flow in a diverse energy. Now, that's a system. The logic of this system is that there's not much room for independence in our electoral politics. Few of them, as we know, are successful in getting elected. When they do, they don't have much leverage in a system in which other people are saying, well, look, I'm prepared to sacrifice some of my local decision-making autonomy for the advantage of being part of a team. And if you're not, well, then you're not going to be part of it. There is, of course, a group that would advocate that we have a system of no political parties. It's a version of the none of the above option. And it really says that we would be better off at the end of the day if we had parliamentary politics with no political parties. That assumes, I suppose, that whatever representatives one would choose would somehow defy the incentives to discipline that would give them power. But it would really mean that we'd be in a very totally and completely different kind of a governmental system. Elections would lose essentially their collective decision-making capacity. So party discipline essentially works against the ability of local representatives to vote the way their constituents want. And that's why I think most of us deep down have a kind of deep ambivalence about political parties. We're voting for a representative. We think they ought to, when they get to the legislature, vote the way the people who elected them want them to vote on some particular issue, a new swimming pool for this town, or keep the hospital open in that community, or whatever, yet except somehow they're going to vote for a party. So there's a deep kind of ambivalence in our attitudes towards it. We want them not to vote for party lines, but we actually think and understand that we can't operate our system without political parties. And that tension persists, because disciplined parties run the system and there's such powerful incentives for them to do so. Any questions? This is a good time maybe to stop. Okay, clear as mud. Excellent. Okay. There is some stuff in the written text about the... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, Ken. I reacted a little late to that.
No.
And in regards to... Skip. In regards to the party whip, what is the party whip's responsibilities and how does he fulfill them?
The party whip is really the term for the person in the parliamentary party responsible for making people show up and vote the party line. So parliamentarians come to the legislature on a Tuesday morning and they suddenly discover there's a bill to amend the Dog Catchers Act of 1903. They know nothing about it, and the party whip tells them our party's for this bill or we're against this bill. As individual members don't know the details of every bill and every activity, and so the party whip really's job is to kind of make sure all the members know what the issue is and what the party's position is. And for party members who are having trouble kind of bringing themselves to do it, they say, you know, they're there to kind of keep the troops in line. Mostly they don't do it with whips, although occasionally they do. It's a kind of carrot and stick activity. You're trying to persuade people that there's good reasons for doing it. You know, we're all contributing. This is good for the party. This is what our people want, et cetera. But sometimes people are quite resistant, and the government has a very small majority. The whip might say, well, you know, you do this or there'll be cost, there'll be price to pay. You know, if you defy the whip continually, maybe we won't renominate you the next election. You know, if you're not going to be part of this team. So the whip is really the person in the on the government side and on the opposition side who kind of keeps the discipline going on a day-to-day basis, i.e. keeps them organized and voting the same way. That's basically their job. Party whips are usually chosen by the leaders of the parliamentary parties, but they choose people, of course, who get on with everybody because you want someone who can kind of jolly everybody along and keep a happy working team, right? Great. Anything else? Okay, there is some stuff in the written text that I'm going to just kind of slip over a little bit about the origins of political parties. There is some very interesting and fascinating stuff that I could go on for hours about the differences between political parties whose origins are those being created by politicians. Parties that start with politicians organizing as compared to parties that start kind of from the grassroots. And they have different kind of organizational styles and traditions. Over time, they come to look more and more like one another if they're competing against one another. But I'm not going to talk a lot about that now. You can find it there, and if we want to talk about it, we can, about those differences. The classic kind of parties created by politicians are the Conservative and Liberal parties of Canada. Parties like the CCF, now NDP, or the Bloc Québécois, are parties that have grown out of the grassroots, and their internal organizational practices are rather different. They nominate candidates differently, but they, since they struggle within the same electoral system, they come over time to look a little bit more like one another. Well, let's turn to the question of the number of parties, because it's going to be something that's going to continue to come back on our agenda and be devilish in one way or another over the next couple of weeks, because it's one of the issues around electoral systems. And we saw from Campbell's red, yellow, brown, blue parliamentary arrangements that the number of parties makes the parliamentary system work differently, and of course it makes the system of competition work differently. Well, how many political parties does the community need anyway? Turns out, I'm sorry to say, Doug, the mathematician, that there isn't actually any mathematical formula that will provide that kind of answer. I checked the website this week. I'm sure Elections BC is up to date, up to the minute. There are now 41 registered political parties in British Columbia. I don't know whether we need 41 or not, but there are groups, enough people out there who think we do, they've registered another one or two, or three or four or five or six. I guess we can expect the electoral system to take care of some of them. I don't know how the Millionaires' Party will do. The Millionaires' Party of British Columbia, I don't know anything about it, but its headquarters is in Gold River. How perfect is that? There's the Bald Eagle Party, and there's a whole series of others. But they represent citizens who've decided they want to kind of organize a party and contest. Most of these 41 probably are not going to have widespread appeal to the public, though I think the public doesn't think it needs 41 different choices. But aside from what the voters will do to those parties or big parties, the electoral system also has a real impact and can have a real impact on the number of parties that are out there, and as we'll see, that then has some impact on the kinds of parties. In general, if we think of the logic of the way that electoral system works, there are two kinds of systems, crudely put. There's lots of variations, but there are systems that are what we would call winner-take-all kinds of systems. The majority-type families and the plurality systems are the predominant ones. And these are systems which deliberately give more seats to some parties than they have votes. So they reward large parties. And the larger parties might get 40% of the vote and 50% of the seats, or 35% of the vote and 40% of the seats. So they're getting more than they're entitled to. Well, if some larger parties are getting a bigger share, somebody must be getting a smaller share. You know, the pie doesn't change. So if someone gets a big piece, someone's got to get a small piece. And so those kind of systems reward big parties and tend to penalize small parties. Well, what does that do? There's a kind of logic that suggests that if you're a small party and you want to be a serious player, if you want to get into office, there's an incentive to kind of come together and to perhaps amalgamate. And over time, there's a kind of logic that suggests that that ought to lead to probably two large parties dominating competition. I mean, if some other smaller parties persist and identify a small clientele, that's fine, but they're not going to win. Because that kind of pressure invariably moves it in a different kind of direction. Proportional systems work very differently. They give parties exactly what the voters want them to get. They get what they're given in terms of seat shares. Well, that's a system which obviously allows more parties to get seats in Parliament. Small parties aren't being driven out by being penalized, perhaps winning no seats. We know there were parties that got 10, 11% of the vote in the last provincial election and got no seats. Now, they might continue to do that year after year after year, or they might pack it in and amalgamate with another party. In a proportional system, they have no incentive to do that. In fact, they'd get their share, and they get to play a part in the parliamentary process. Proportional systems allow more parties to win seats, and that inevitably, of course, provides a chance for more new parties to emerge. Because if you're in that kind of system, you say, well, look, even if we only get 5% of the votes, we'll get some seats, and then we'll have some kind of say. Our voice, at least, will be heard. It may not win. It might not be the majority, but we'll be there. And we'll be heard, and we'll be participating in the legislative process. And if it's kind of coalition politics, we might have some influence in who gets to form the government. And so that's a system which, by and large, tends to lead to party competition with many parties, or more parties, multi-party competition, if you like. And we've seen this logic powerfully at work in this country in the last few months. And that's what the whole Canadian Alliance Progressive Conservative business has been about. You know, they've been split for the last 10 years, and both of them have been getting fewer seats in terms of their share than the votes would suggest. Conservatives were getting 15-16% of the vote and virtually no seats. The Alliance were getting a few more seats, but still less. And the Liberals were getting a lot more seats than they were entitled to. And finally, the Alliance and Conservative parties were saying, well, look, this is crazy. We're going to be in opposition forever. If we combine, maybe we'll become one of those large parties and we'll get a bigger share and we might possibly win. We might be able to beat the Liberals. Whether they will or not remains to be seen. But the reason they're coming together is because they buy this logic. Because it's kind of the logic of the split vote that they talk about. So we've seen this kind of thing powerfully in practice. If there was a proportional system, those two parties wouldn't have any incentive to amalgamate. The Alliance could go along and they could win their share of the seats. The Conservatives could go along and win their share of the seats. If they did reasonably well together in Parliament, they might have more seats than the Liberals. They can't get them because of the plurality system is penalizing them and rewarding the Liberals. Well, that logic works pretty well, powerfully across the country. The Canadian provinces are amongst the most clear examples of this logic at work. Almost all the provinces of the country, with the exception of an unnamed province next door to the east, operate essentially two-party systems. It's not because there aren't other voices trying to get in, but because the logic of this system has reduced most provincial politics most of the time to a pretty clear two-party
kind of competition. Extremely difficult for people to break that. And in fact, where parties sometimes do break it, they often end up becoming a replica of the party that they replaced. We can think of the Liberals breaking into the province 10 or 15 years ago in the early 1990s. They did so, in the end, by replacing the Socreds. Well, a lot of people would argue that they kind of look like the Socreds, you know, or a modern version of it. And that's not surprising, because they're essentially attracting the votes of the people who before were voting for that party. So a new party can break in, but it can break in kind of really by replacing one of the old parties in that kind of a system. And then they end up looking like the old party, maybe with another name or a different color or a leader and so on. So there's a kind of powerful logic, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest it's at work in this country. Anything? Yes, Jeremy.
What is the present criteria for establishing a party in British Columbia?
I think it's trivial. I think you have to have a name and address of a president and an organization. You may have to collect a few signatures. I can't remember. I think not, though. So almost anybody can register a party. We could easily be the Citizens' Assembly Party of British Columbia if we wanted, if someone wanted to take that initiative. I don't know if they'd let us, you know, put the WAS Center down as our headquarters, but the criteria for a party for getting your label on the ballot may be different in different systems. In Canada, for many years now, you could register as a political party by collecting a certain number of signatures. Then if you wanted to be a party at the election time and have your party label on the ballot, you had to run 50 candidates. That made it impossible for there to be a Bloc BC, by the way, because there aren't 50 seats in British Columbia. The Supreme Court has now just said, well, wait a minute, that's unconstitutional, and struck down that. And parliaments themselves have different rules for what constitutes a parliamentary party. The House of Commons for many years has said official parties have 12 members. That's a purely arbitrary number whooshed out of the air. Actually, it's not really arbitrary, because in the 1960s, the Liberals were desperate to get the support of the Ralliement Créditiste in a minority situation. The Ralliement Créditiste, I think, had 14 or 15 members, but a couple of them looked shaky, so they said, well, let's call 12 an official party, and then they can be an official party and then get some money and a leadership and so on. So these numbers sometimes have kind of curious kinds of origins. So curiously enough, in federally, the criteria for being a party to be registered and get tax credits is one thing. The criteria to be a party to kind of run an election, have your name on the ballot, is another thing. Criteria for a party in parliament is yet another thing. So, because parties are operating at different levels, the levels of voters, the levels of politicians, the levels of governments, and so on. But in British Columbia, we probably have 41 because it's pretty easy to become a party. In fact, I think it'd be harder to make it really easier and open. And some would argue that that's a good thing because that opens the process to as many people as possible. Others would say, well, they're sort of a nuisance and, you know, they take up paper. Well, it's hard to know whether there are such things as nuisances in a democracy, but they really haven't clogged up the system. If we had 41 parties in the provincial legislature, if we had a system in which if you got 1% of the vote, you could, you know, then people might have different kind of judgments, but that's one of the kinds of things we're going to be concerned with. Yes, Sheila.
With a multi-party system, if it promotes chances for smaller parties to stay, is it correct to assume that those smaller parties get to stay more true to their beliefs?
That's a really good question, because it raises the question about, is there a connection between the numbers of party and the kinds of parties? And that's just what I want to talk about now. So, extra dessert for Sheila. It's not just the number of parties that might be influenced by the electoral rules, but the kind of parties that might exist because of the incentives at play. Let's go back and think about the poor old Alliance and Conservative parties. Why have they been separate parties for the last two decades? Well, there's probably a lot of personal reasons, but they disagreed about the way politics ought to be organized. The Alliance had a kind of grassroots populist conception. The Conservatives had a much more traditional parliamentary solution. They had very different views about what the appropriate social policies ought to be for this country. They certainly differed on questions of federal-provincial relations, the links between English and French-speaking Canada. They had very different orientations and different policies. And they had very different views on even the role of the central government. The Alliance was much keener on shrinking the national government and putting power at the level of the provinces. The Conservatives were much less keen on that. So they existed partly because, as Sheila implies, they had a kind of set of policies. Now, if they're going to come together, they're going to have to, what's the phrase, water that down, find ways to build kind of compromises. They're going to try and do that because they want to try and appeal to more people. They want to become what Canadian political scientists sometimes call brokerage parties. They want to be brokers between this interest and that interest and another interest. People in the Maritimes want this. People in Quebec want that. People in Ontario want this. Well, they all can't get what they want, but we can give them something of it. And so you get parties that are going to be bigger, because being bigger helps you win more seats under a plurality system. But by being bigger, you have to have a kind of much more of a catch-all. Something for everybody kind of orientation. When you do that, you probably have a much less clear, specific, focused set of programs and policies. And that's, in some sense, precisely what's going to happen to that party. Gosh, they may end up going back looking like the Conservatives of the 1980s. They split over policy issues. They're probably going to come back for that kind of reasons. So if you shrink the number of parties, if you go to a system that encourages fewer parties, you might have a kind of clear either or choice, but you're going to have much more general, specific, one might argue, vague organizations. They're going to be much less sharply defined in terms of their policy programs. They become great machines for vacuuming up votes, right? I don't know how many of you do the vacuuming in your house. I actually do a lot of it in our house. And, you know, when you go through on the carpet, you've got the power beater going. But when you come to the drapes, you don't put that big power beater up. You can put on a different attachment. And then if you want to get all that gunk out between the pillows, there's another long thing at the end of the vacuum that gets that out. So you have a whole lot of different attachments. Well, these are parties that have lots of attachments because they're trying to find votes from different kind of groups. If you are just in the business of vacuuming up votes, you know, from the drapes, then you have a party that's just, you know, a one-function kind of organization, right? You don't need all those other attachments because you're just appealing to the left-handed, blue-eyed separatists in Quebec. So you don't need the power beater. You just need the attachment that gets those votes. So these big catch-all votes are kind of parties are vote vacuum machines that have a dozen attachments to attract votes everywhere. So the differences between two-party competition and multi-party competition isn't just about the numbers. It's also about the kinds of parties that are out there in that system, and then the kind of competitive dynamic. If you have two great big parties that look pretty much the same in their policies, competing with one another, they produce one kind of competition that often tends to revolve around questions of leadership and personality and so on. That's going to be a very different kind of competition than when you've got a whole lot of parties saying, this is the most important issue and this is the way we'll deal with it, and representing different kind of positions. And that's going to lead to very different kind of voter responses. In simple ways, we might say that two-party competition produces a pretty simple and simplified kind of choice between two parties that are pretty similar and who, in fact, have every incentive to minimize their differences. You know, if the Conservatives and Alliance find a way to kind of minimize their differences and come together, the next step will be for them to try and minimize their differences with the Liberals to try and win some of the votes of people who are now voting Liberal so they can win. So it's an incentive to kind of move to the center to minimize differences and produce a kind of simple choice. It's one in which the voters can then say, well, we'll have, you know, Pepsi or we'll have Coke or we'll have however everyone wants to think about it. We can make that choice, and that choice will determine who forms the government because there are only two choices and one of them is going to win. Political debate and bargaining doesn't disappear in that kind of politics. It just takes place inside these big, sprawling, catch-all parties. The debates and the divisions take place within the caucuses, within the party rooms, as the parties struggle to maintain discipline, because the larger the tent you build, the harder it is to kind of maintain that discipline, because there's always somebody who's wanting to lurch the party in this direction or that direction. So the same kind of debates go on. They just go on in a different place and probably a more private kind of place. A multi-party competition is different. There ought to be wider choice among more ideological parties, or at least parties with much more explicit positions, determined to represent that position, not necessarily to represent some kind of common good, if there is such a thing. Elections allow, in some sense, then expressions of preference, because people can then indicate what party they prefer and what issues they want brought to the fore. And in those kind of systems, political bargaining at a governmental level tends to take place between parties in the legislature. So same kind of bargaining goes on over the same kind of issues. It's more likely to be between parties. In two-party competition, it tends to be within these big parties. And there are advantages and probably disadvantages to both those sorts of things. And if you change the electoral system, the kind of things I've been talking about suggest that there's a logic that ought to then lead us to a change in the kind of numbers of parties and the kind of competition. And let me give you a very simplified example of what happened in New Zealand. There's a lot up in the board, but basically it kind of goes through this sort of thing. New Zealand in the 1990s decided to abandon a plurality winner-take-all system and go to a more proportional system, a mixed proportional system. We'll learn about mixed proportional systems in a couple of weeks. Under the plurality system, before the electoral system reform, they had basically two big parties, a Labour Party and a National Party. Looked pretty much like the NDP and the Liberal Party here. They even had a few Socreds, the only other place in the world that had Socreds getting elected. Only one or two in the corners, but, you know, there they were. These were parties that had the kind of broad appeal trying to represent and speak to large parts of the community. And they over the years, had become less and less ideological, harder and harder to tell major differences between them. In fact, one of the reasons in the end there was a kind of rebellion by the people against the system was because the Labour Party was behaving like the old National Party, and the National Party was behaving like the old Labour Party, and no one could tell the difference because they were competing for those same kind of votes. Elections, though, tended to determine governments. If you had a choice between Labour and National, the election threw up one of them at the end of the day as a winner, and governments were one-party majority governments. Well, for a number of reasons, including a lot of dissatisfaction with the way that process had been working in New Zealand and the flip-flops between parties and the whole kind of economic reform agenda, which had kind of disrupted the patterns of established New Zealand life for half a century, there was a great demand for a electoral system reform. It came, and it's still settling down. You change the electoral system, and it doesn't overnight change the system. It takes two or three elections, because elections are, and political parties are solutions to voters' problems and politicians' problems. They've got to figure out the new solution. You know, it doesn't kind of come out of the blue. They've got to try one thing the first time. Oh, I'm quite sure. So they've now had three elections, and the process is beginning to settle down. It's a bit more predictable than it was the first time. But it's quite clear now that in Parliament, at least, there are at least two big parties. Labour and National are still there. They're still by far the biggest parties who still dominate. But there are at least five other parties now in most New Zealand parliaments. There are parties that represent distinctive, identifiable interests. There's a Green Party. There's a called Taxpayers' Party. It's a party of people who don't want to pay taxes, basically. And it has a kind of right-wing ideological position. But there are also some other parties that are really kind of personal machines that are the extension of big personalities. There's a party called New Zealand First, which is just the kind of the rump of a whole lot of people who like a guy who's a charismatic politician. So there's some big parties and now a bunch of small parties and a range of different kinds of political parties. So elections now are much more complex sets of choices, and we'll see the way their system works that people have two kinds of choices as well. Increasing elections are going to be to reflect the preferences, because everybody knows that no single party is going to win one of these elections. So some kind of coalition is going to probably come out of it. Politicians in advance of the election say, well, if we win or if we get lots of seats, we might agree to work with those people. We would never agree to work with these people. And sometimes they change their mind after they get elected, and sometimes they don't. And so there are some signals that are going out, but basically voters got to say, well, which of these parties do we like and why? We're going to vote for them and then let them sort it out with, depending on who else has got what other shares when it's done. Clara.
Yes. Okay. Thing about the New Zealand system, is it true that they have seats set aside for the Maori?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that goes back.
How does that work? Like, how did they establish that?
It's sort of complicated. It goes back to the founding, really, of responsible government in New Zealand. And a number of seats were set aside for Maori people. The number is unfixed, because Maori people have two options. They can either register as Maori and go on a Maori voting list, or they can register and go on the national voting list with everybody else. If they all registered and went on the national voting list, there'd be no Maori seats. So in some sense, the system is designed so that and about half of the Maoris are on the Maori list, I think, now, and about half are on the national list. And so before every election, they decide how many Maoris have registered in the Maori list. And let's say, I think there are now 4 Maori seats, 3 in the North Island and 1 in the South Island. And if you do that, then you get assigned to a Maori constituency, and you vote in those constituencies, and they're organized geographically. If you have opted to be on the regular list, then you just vote with all the other New Zealand citizens. So it's a historic system that's quite flexible, and it reflects really two kinds of voters' lists, but people have a choice to be on one or the other. Yes?
Could I ask what vehicle was used to bring that change about?
Basically, it kind of came about by accident, because a politician misread his briefing notes in a television interview and promised that there would be a royal commission and a referendum. He was supposed to say there wouldn't be. That was, but he did and kept his promise. And so they had a royal commission, and it's called, I think, Towards a Better Democracy. It's a very wonderfully written document. And basically they said, well, it went through all the criteria. Who were 2 or 3 different options? And then the government hemmed and hawed, because the two big parties were not keen on this. And so they said, well, we're going to have a kind of preferential referendum. And they put out, I think, 3 options, the present system and a couple of other alternatives, and kind of not any one of them won. And so then they had a kind of follow-up referendum, because there was a growing popular demand to go down this route. And so at the end of the second referendum, the mixed proportional system won, and the government implemented it. So it was a long process, political miscues, royal commission, referendum, another referendum, a lot of debate. It went on through the mid-1990s. Elizabeth McClay is going to be here in the 5th week. Elizabeth has been part of a team that's for the last decade analyzed what's happened in a country that's changed its system, what's happened to its parliament, what's happened to its parties, what's happened to its government and the way government's organized. And this is an example of a system that was very much like ours that did make this change. And she's going to talk about a lot of the ways in which some of the things that were expected came about, some of the things that were unexpected came about. And so we'll get a chance to kind of ask in detail about some of those kinds of things. So now we have elections that do reflect preferences, and we have multi-party parliamentary coalitions. Those coalitions are relatively stable. New Zealanders have elections every 3 years, and governments tend to last 3 years. The last two coalitions have been headed by Helen Clark, the leader of the Labour Party, and with a number of small fringe parties attached to her coalition. But very different kind of politics emerging because you change the electoral system, and it works through the business of it works through political parties. It doesn't directly change the system of government, changes the parties, the numbers, the kinds, the competition, and ultimately working through TANAs.
Something I'm just a little bit stuck on is the difference between opposition, official opposition, and if we were to have more of a mixed proportional legislature, would we still have something called an official opposition, things like that? Like, I know right now we only have two members of an opposition in our legislature, but they don't have official status, meaning they don't get funding or... Just if you could clarify that
for me. The British Columbia system, as I recall, says that to be recognized as an official party in the legislature, you have to have four members. And if you're not a party, you're just kind of two independents who calling yourself a party. So that's, you know, the number could be one, it could be three, it happens to be four. It was arbitrarily chosen. The current government could have chosen it by a vote of the legislature, because that's a decision that the legislature made some time ago, that will be the base number. They could have reduced it to two to accommodate the opposition. They didn't. The official opposition is a term that makes most sense in a kind of parliamentary two-party kind of competition. There's a government, and then there's the official big O, capital O, official opposition, kind of the government in waiting. In coalition systems, we could call one of the parties the official opposition, but it wouldn't have the same kind of connotation. The connotation we use is the opposition is kind of the alternative government. Well, multi-party systems don't have alternative governments. They have maybe alternative parliamentary combinations, but it's not entirely clear, because you could have as Campbell showed, a red-blue combination or a yellow-brown combination or a yellow-brown-green combination, or you get lots of different kinds of combinations. So the notion of the official opposition doesn't make as much sense in that kind of system. Okay, I'm going to move on. I'm going to be a little careful about my time here. There is some quite wonderful stuff, because it reflects Carty's theory of Canadian parties, in the text. I'm just going to skip over that. We can come back to it later this afternoon if you like when we come back. We'll talk a little bit about the nature of Canadian political parties. My theory that they really are kind of elaborate franchise systems. And the way you think about Canadian parties is to think about them as a... They're not exactly the McDonald's of political life or the Canadian Tire of political life, but they really are a kind of franchise sort of organization. Those might well change under different kinds of electoral arrangements. But I do want to say one or two things about changing party organization, because it really kind of follows on some of the themes we've been talking about. If you change party types, not only do you change kind of the appeals they make, but you're likely to have a good deal of impact on the internal organizational life of the parties and how they go about doing their business. And one of the things that probably concerns us, because we're concerned with turning votes and popular support into parliamentary seats, is where the candidates come from. And electoral systems are likely to have a considerable impact on that. The electoral system may regulate that, and in some countries they're very tightly regulated. In other cases, the electoral system might say, well, it's up to the parties to get their candidates, whoever they want, however they want, in whatever way they want. But as a general rule, in the plurality or majority kinds of systems, these are candidates are standing in single districts trying to represent the people of a particular individual locale. And so those are systems in which the political parties have a lot of incentive to let the local members of their party or local voters or local supporters choose those candidates. Because if they do that, they're more likely to get a candidate that the locals can live with. If, you know, Ottawa suddenly said to people in Prince George, well, we're going to decide who your candidate is, people in Prince George say, well, maybe you are, and maybe we're not going to vote for them. But if the people in that riding choose their own candidates, it's much more likely they'll come up with someone who is likely to be acceptable. So those kind of systems, because of the way they're structured, are more likely to produce that kind of dynamic. Party list systems, where people are, in some sense, not voting for individual candidates, but for parties, and these are some of the kind of proportional systems we'll talk about later, really require that a party produce a kind of whole list of candidates that'll go on the ballot, because you're not actually voting for candidates. You may well be just voting for a party. We vote for Party A or Party B or Party C, and if Party A gets 10% of the votes, then they get their 10% of their candidates, and usually they're the top 10 on the list or something like that. There are lots of variations. Well, if a party has to produce a list of candidates, ultimately someone in the central apparatus of the party, the leader or the party bureaucracy, has to kind of produce that list. There has to be some kind of final, definitive coordination of it. So those kinds of systems are more likely to produce candidate selection processes that are more centralized and more bureaucratized. the law can be written to prevent it. Political parties can organize differently. But even where they do, even where the form is that local members are consulted, at the end of the day, the party leadership often has a good deal of say in how the consultations of Region A and Region B and Region C are put together and candidates are produced. So party leaders, party bureaucrats often have a much greater influence in that kind of process. Preferential systems, I said up there, that voters get to determine. That's not entirely true, because parties in preferential systems will nominate a number of candidates, but typically they all won't get elected. So in a preferential system, a party, like a single transferable vote, a party may nominate four or five candidates. Only one or two of them are likely to get elected. So in the end of the day, it's the voters who are ultimately going to decide who the successful, at least, candidates are going to be. And there's a very different dynamic, because the parties then know that whatever they do, whoever they throw up, is not going to be very determinative. I mean, you know, in a safe Liberal seat, the Liberals know whoever they nominate is going to get elected. Except if the voters in the end decide which of the three Liberals are going to get elected, then they have to respond and organize that process in a very different kind of way. So these systems also then kind of spill into the internal life of the parties, but they flow back out to questions about candidate selection. And, of course, candidate selection is often a key part of the electoral process, because it's these candidates ultimately that are seeking our votes. So here are some questions to think about in general kinds of ways, and to kind of mull over and to kind of reflect on. I mean, does it matter how many parties we have? I mean, would we want all 41 parties to be actively pursuing our votes at election time? Is 6 enough? Is 14 enough? Can you even decide that sort of thing? Is there any kind of simple answer? Do we want to have an electoral system that makes it easier for more parties to grow, for more parties to emerge? Or do we want to make it a little bit harder for more parties to emerge, so that we're not going to have 14 parties on the ballot? You know, that we think that would make choice impossible and crazy. Ultimately, is multi-party or two-party combination going to be better for British Columbia? At the end of the day, that's going to be one of the hardest questions we have to answer in terms of what kind of electoral system we might want to recommend. If we think that two-party competition is what we need in this province, then maybe we're going to recommend that we're not going to change the system. If we think that two-party competition has a lot of downsides and that we'd be better off with a different kind of competition in British Columbia, a different kind of electoral politics, a different way of relating to politicians, then we might want to think about electoral systems that facilitate a different kind of competition with more parties. We might want to think about the whole process of candidate selection. Who do we think candidates ought to be chosen by? If we're determined to kind of choose them in our own localities, then certain kind of centralized one-party list systems might not be what we want. So these are questions for debate and reflection, because they're going ultimately to be some way, when we make decisions about electoral systems, we're implicitly answering those questions. So if we can explicitly ask them, we can go some way, I think, in terms of getting towards where we want to be. Okay, I've come to the end of my time. Everyone's, I think, still awake. I'm delighted to see. I'm not sure about Brad here. He sits behind me, so I can't tell. He told me that's why. Any questions before we break? We will come back at the end of the discussion groups this afternoon and coffee to kind of have a wrap-up, and we can talk about any of the things we talked about this morning or this afternoon. But before we go, is there anything? Yes, Jack.
Back on the question about multi-party versus two-party competition, in your slide, you made the point that a two-party system provides incentives for the two parties to kind of migrate towards one another ideologically in order to widen their appeal to the electorate. But I think, you know, the perception that a lot of people have of BC, which is arguably a two-party system, is that we have very sharply ideologically polarized parties, and that changing party governments leads to very abrupt changes of direction. So it's less a case of the two parties migrating towards the center and more a case of polarization. I just wondered if you had any comment on that.
Yes, I think that, you know, that if the society is kind of divided, and it has been in those rhetorical terms, that can happen. I think one of the responses might also be that what you do is get a divorce between rhetoric and practice. And there have been, for historical reasons and organizational reasons, good reasons for the parties to kind of have a rhetorical style as polar. The New Democrats traditionally trying to appeal to a trade union-based, organized, working-class kind of vote. The old Socreds appealing to a kind of anti-vote. But that, over time, in fact, you know, this isn't hardcore socialist versus hardcore capitalist, right? They basically agree on most elements of the social security system, the tax system. They differ around the margins on particular programs. You know, should or should we not have automobile insurance? But this, you know, capitalism at stake isn't at stake over this. So, in some sense, what's happened in places like British Columbia and certainly happened in Britain. All the people in the Labour Party now complain about that in Britain. I think that Tony Blair is just a conservative, but with a different kind of rhetoric. So one of the things that two-party competition can sometimes do is provide an incentive to kind of separate rhetoric from reality. And multi-party competition, there's no incentive. In fact, the incentives are to be really clear as to what your positions are because you're trying to attract votes to that particular position and essentially force sworn those of other sides. So politicians in two-party systems are playing a kind of curious game, kind of moving towards one another, trying to win their votes in all kinds of ways, but maintaining a kind of rhetorical position for their kind of hardcore traditional support. So because they have to maintain their kind of support, but win the support of the other side to cross that 50% threshold. Yes. Anne.
A question about the parameters that we can work within. In our discussion group this morning, we hit the issue of whether we'd be able to, say, change the number of representatives if we did want to, say, use a mixed system. People still wanted local representation, but we wanted some proportionality.
I don't think that the mandate doesn't speak about whether we can recommend a legislative assembly of 120 or 33 or any other size. I think we operate on the assumption that we're recommending a system for the assembly of the size it is, 79. Different systems work a little bit differently depending on the size of the assembly, and we'll get into this when we talk about mixed systems that one might argue they would work a little bit differently probably if the assembly was a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller. But I think we're operating on the assumption that it's 79. And then any of these systems can work in assemblies of that size. An assembly of 300 is different than an assembly of 79, not only in terms of the systems, but in terms of a lot of things that can happen. One of the difficulties of working in small parliamentary systems is very often that the opposition is too small to be very effective in any event. The government's winning the majority in a small assembly. If you have 40 or 50 members in an assembly, like in New Brunswick or Nova Scotia, and the government's won, let's say, 35 or 40 seats, that only leaves 10 for the opposition. Hardly enough to kind of do a job mounting an opposition. So size does make a difference. But I don't think, for our purposes, it's a critical kind of concern. Okay, well, why don't we, do we have coffee or, yes, I guess breaks first?
No, it's breaks to our discussion groups. And first of all, let's thank Ken Carty. We're going to our discussion groups, and there was some talk of changing. The gallery discussion groups did not work as well as they should have, but they've rearranged the tables. Hopefully the configuration of tables will work better. If not, then we'll find different rooms, either in the concourse or something else. So discussion groups, and then 3:30 in the concourse, 4 o'clock back here. Thanks very much.